I know one guy who thought that he was the only person that could control these particular elephants. And he would demonstrate his dominion over them by making them kneel in front of him. And that he would put his foot on them and show that he could control them. I think it harkens back to circuses, but, you know, the lion tamer would show that the lion tamer could put its head in the lion's mouth because the lion wouldn't dare to eat the lion tamer. So it seemed to be a way to gain respect and to show that they were the top dog.
Welcome to Anthropomania. I'm Jay Ingram. This podcast is about the wonderful, complicated, sometimes hilarious, but way more often destructive ways that we humans interact with the living world around us. Animals, plants, microbes, whatever. Sometimes, even with the best intentions, our humanness gets us, but way more often them, in trouble. And today, we're going to dive into the fantastic, bizarre world of rich people who own exotic animals.
Like Mike Tyson.
Oh, Nikki Wilson. Why would you suggest Mike Tyson?
Well, he's famous for owning three beautiful white tigers that he allegedly bought with the help of his car dealer just before he got out of prison. Supposedly, he now thinks that it was a bad idea, but back then he thought it was lit.
Okay, Erica Siren, what do you think about Mike Tyson as an uber-rich zoo guy?
Yes, Mike Tyson is an uber-rich zoo guy, but there are many types of uber-rich zoo guys that fall into several categories. And in those categories, you have one of two camps. In one camp, you have the places where science and welfare are prioritized. These are our accredited zoos, our captive breeding facilities and sanctuaries. And in the other camp, you have places where, well, welfare and science isn't really at the top of the agenda. These are our unaccredited roadside zoos, our circuses, our commercial farms, and yes, our individual pet owners like Mike Tyson.
And there's also social media, don't forget, where you can show off your wild pet to millions of adoring followers.
Yeah, and the great advantage is you don't have to go to somebody's zoo. You just turn on your phone and you can see the exotics right there. We're going to be talking about that later. But first, you're calling him a pet owner?
I'm calling him a pet owner.
Okay, so I've got to say, guys, pet owning doesn't really cut it. It's kind of minor league when it comes to most of the stuff we're going to talk about. So when I think of rich people owning zoos, I think of people like Pablo Escobar, you know, wealthy, extremely wealthy Colombian drug lord. His Hacienda Napolis actually still exists today, but it's been turned into an amusement park. But it once had kangaroos, giraffes, elephants, hippos, all of them gone to other zoos or other places. Well, except the notorious hippos remain, but that's a whole story in itself, and we're going to cover that in a future episode.
I can't wait. But in the meantime, Escobar wasn't alone. There's also the very wealthy and very famous newspaper tycoon, William Randolph Hearst, who in the 1930s owned the biggest private zoo in the world. It was called the Hearst Garden of Comparative Zoology. And just as an aside, for those of you who don't know where the word zoo comes from, it's an abbreviated form of zoological gardens. But anyway, Hearst had 50 different species of herbivores like deer, zebras, emus, kangaroos, you know, from all over the world. And he would entertain his guests in the garden as the animals looked on, chewing their cud.
You know we have to talk about Tiger King.
Oh, God, Tiger King. Can't get away from that guy.
Okay, well, you know, I have to admit, he's not Mike Tyson, because Mike Tyson topped out at three tigers. And I think we agree that really doesn't qualify. Tiger King had way more tigers than that. But boy, if anyone's a roadside zookeeper, that guy is. I would grudgingly include him with Pablo Escobar and William Randolph Hearst. Yeah, so, you know, there is Escobar. There was Michael Jackson's zoo in California, Hearst's and so on. But in Anthropomania, we're not interested so much in what range of animals there were in this array of zoos, but the people themselves, particularly their motivation. Why do some people, like the ones we've mentioned, collect vast numbers of exotic and dangerous animals? Are they, I'll just give you a few choices, are they just eccentrics with a lot of money? Is it all ego? I mean, Suzanne McDonald kind of touched on that. Is it power? Is it even hoarding gone wild? And does the love of animals ever play a significant role?
Is it like the lady with 50 cats, but with money?
And now, the love of animals might play a role with the woman of 50 cats, but is it significant in these other cases? And I'll reluctantly accept that we can tease out the idea. Is there a common thread all the way from Escobar and Hearst to Tiger King? So, you know, yeah, you have to be an expert in both human behavior and animal behavior to figure out what's going on here. And that is exactly how I would describe Dr. Suzanne McDonald.
I'm Dr. Suzanne McDonald. I'm a professor of psychology and biology at York University, and I study animal behavior.
So we're interested not so much in the animal behavior, but in the human behavior around animals. We want to know about the motivation of that.
I watched Tiger King. Did you watch Tiger King?
Yes.
It's super disturbing. The reason it was so interesting is because you're trying to figure out what is happening here? Because the motivations are so strange. It's clearly not animal welfare. That's not the motivation. It's clearly not about conservation. That's not the motivation. You never see Tiger Kings that have like hamsters. It's always elephants or tigers or giant things with big teeth because they want to show that they are the only ones who can deal with these animals and they have a special way. And in Tiger King, certainly that was a great way to attract women. So evolutionarily, maybe it's in our genes that these men want to show off their wealth and this is the particular way that they do it. Certainly that was Tiger King.
Part of it is collecting too, it appears. Although, you know, you wonder if somebody that collects English China really has anything to do with somebody who collects tigers. But, you know, I've heard the suggestion that, you know, the little old lady down the street or the man who lives by himself and has 50 cats, if that person had money, they might create their own zoo. Do you think that there's possibly that kind of commonality?
I do. And I think what little evidence there is suggests that hoarding, animal hoarding, is a particular type of hoarding, and that it does have brain mechanisms in common with this kind of collection of things. But animal hoarders are often, they're not hoarding tigers, you know, they're hoarding cats or small things, and they very much believe that they're doing the right thing and that they're helping these animals, even though they're not, and it's an obvious example of this passive cruelty that we see that, you know, having 50 cats in itself is a cruel thing, right? You can't have 50 cats in a one-bedroom apartment. And that's very different than the guy who gets a bear cub and keeps it in his one-bedroom apartment in New York City, which is a real thing. That guy has a very different motivation than the little old lady who has a bunch of cats because she thinks that she has a special connection with cats and that the cats are better off with her than with anybody else. But it's the wildness, it's the exotic animals that I think that brings it to a different level beyond hoarding. It's more of a, look at me, I am special, I'm attracting attention. It's like the guy on the subway who has a bird or a snake on his shoulder. I always think about these guys. There are these guys, you see them and you go, what are you doing? Like, it's not for the animal, but it's to get attention, right? And that guy could be Tiger King and that guy could have a menagerie for sure because of the attention that it gets. And if you think of Tiger King, of course, he loved getting filmed, even though the film made him look ridiculous and he ended up going to jail. But it doesn't matter because it was about the attention. So I think there is a difference between the little old lady and the guy with the snake on the subway.
It's interesting because probably in Tiger King, although he cuddles them, animal welfare doesn't appear to be at the top of the list.
No, but if you ask him, he'd say that he loves his animals. Everybody says, I love my animals. I love them. I love them. And then you say, well, why don't you implement standard welfare protocols? And they say, no, you don't understand. I love my animals. So yeah, it's not about the animal. It's about them and what they get from having the animal, exhibiting the animal, behaving with the animal, and showing off the animal. If nobody watched him, he wouldn't have those animals. That's the case with all the people who have menageries. If nobody knew they had them, they wouldn't have them.
You've spent a lot of time around zoos. Have you ever experienced that feeling that, oh, wow, if I had Pablo Escobar kind of money, I could have my own zoo?
Never, not once. Ever. And I work with urban wildlife as well, with raccoons. And I hear from men in the United States where it is okay to have raccoons as pets. And one fellow has 40 living in his house. And he's always like, well, surely you have some. No, I don't have raccoons because no, that's not a good idea. So no, I have absolutely no desire to have any of these things. I enjoy learning about them and observing them, but I do not need to have them. And that's the difference, is that these people need to have them. They need to possess them and own them. And that's a pretty weird thing. But that's why the pet trade exists. And that's why there are raccoons in Japan and South Korea, because people order them off the internet. So yeah, it's a pretty common feeling, I think.
Well, there's a lot to think about there. What do you think, Nikki, Erica?
Suzanne just really helped me understand why I could not finish watching Tiger King. And part of it is this a bit about attention. I just felt like I couldn't give him my attention. I found it disturbing and I just didn't want to bear witness to it, I guess. And I guess that's what he's after.
This notion of dominance and attention is something that keeps coming up. And, you know, I can't help but wonder how much dominance Hamster King has over his menagerie. Do you think it hits different?
Yeah. Or Gerbil King or Rat King.
Rat King.
The real estate costs are way less, though, if you're Hamster King.
Not as impressive, which I think is the point. You know, we were talking about Tiger King, and that's one modern example, but there's lots of them.
It was a famous case, I think it was in Ohio a few years ago, a man, he'd again amassed a collection of wild animals of various kinds, including bears, tigers, and so on.
So that is James Serple.
My name is James Serple. I'm professor of animal welfare and ethics at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine. And my main area of interest is the relationship between humans and animals.
So the guy James is talking about here is Terry Thompson, and specifically his role in the Great Zanesville Zoo Escape. Zanesville, it's about an hour east of Columbus, Ohio. And one day in 2011, 62-year-old Terry Thompson woke up, he unlocked the gates, and let his entire collection of exotic animals out to roam free.
Freedom!
We're talking about tigers, lions, 17 of them, 8 bears, 3 cougars, some wolves, a baboon, and even a macaque.
He then had some kind of emotional breakdown and released all of the animals and then killed himself. And the local police department had to deal with all these animals wandering around. And the result was that they shot all of these animals. Unfortunately, in this country, there's very few restrictions on people's private ownership of these animals. You've seen it all in things like Tiger King and other things like that. But it's a big mistake. These are large, dangerous animals. They're very expensive to keep. It's the kind of thing that really ought to be strictly regulated, both for the sake of the general public and for the sake of the animals. In natural tiger populations, every so often they throw a mutation. So it has dark stripes, but the fur, instead of being sort of a nice sandy orangey-brown color, is white. And these animals are highly prized. They're prized because they're novel. You know, they look odd. They look interesting. Like all tigers, their faces are very easily anthropomorphized. You know, that nice round face and beautiful eyes set in the round face and a kind of nice smiley kind of expression on the face, like all cats, actually. But these white tigers attract particular appeal. And all of these roadside zoos and these folks who perform on stage in Las Vegas and things like that, they want white tigers, because that's what the public wants to see, because it's dramatic and interesting. But the trouble is, the original founding population of these white tigers was very tiny, so they've been inbreeding them for decades now. As a result, white tigers have a massive number of health problems associated with inbreeding. So many of them have all sorts of difficulties in life, some of which are painful and cause stress and poor welfare to the animals. So this is an example where the human sort of taste for novelty to seeing not just a tiger in captivity, but a white tiger in captivity, can lead down the line to all of these animal welfare issues that really are completely unnecessary. Nobody should be breeding white tigers. It's a pointless and stupid thing to do.
We've focused a lot on the motivation of these people that own large exotic pets. But what Serples really reminded us of there is that this has a major impact on the welfare of animals. Many of these animals are neglected and they are living lives so far removed from what they would have been doing in the wild.
Even just the scale of it is something to marvel. This isn't a multi-million dollar industry. This is a multi-billion dollar industry.
One that's booming.
Yeah, and that's shocking. You know, if I could just go back to tigers for a sec. This has many layers that are not very admirable. So for instance, the tigers that generally tend to get traded in the U.S. are not actually, you know, wild tigers that are owned by individuals. These are crossbred, so-called generic variants, and they have nothing to do with conservation. You could not take, no one would want to take any of these crossbreeds and reintroduce them to the wild. So that's had one major impact. The American government has been very slow to get involved in regulating this trade. Why? Because they're not just white tigers, like James Serples mentioned. They're matings between lions and tigers. Male lions with female tigers or vice versa, or then you get some of those crossbreeds and you know, you've got animals that don't exist anywhere except in the exotic animal trade in the U.S. And let me just say one other thing too. One of the main things about roadside zoos that have tigers is that you can cuddle the cubs. And, you know, Serples mentioned their faces are lovely. That you can only do that up to about the time they're 100 days old. Then they're too dangerous. And then what do? Many of these zoos just get rid of them. They trade them. They sell them off because they're too dangerous.
Those tigers that are falling outside of U.S. regulations or North American regulations still contribute to conservation problems, though. They drive issues around the world because they popularize owning an exotic pet.
Exactly. And, you know, the trade, I mean, Erica mentioned that it's billions of dollars, but, you know, you can, like, do either of you want a zebra? I mean, they're kind of nice, right? They're mean, actually.
How much does a zebra cost? You know, if this is a multi-billion dollar industry, are they expensive or are they kind of affordable?
Well, $4,000, is that affordable? I mean, you know, for a guy like Tiger King, he was even selling cubs, I think, for in the hundreds of dollars, but he was churning them out so he could afford to do that. But, you know, the more exotic, the rarer the animal, the more impressive it is to own, the more money you can get for it. But, you know, you can just go online or, you know, make a phone call and get an animal. It's incredible.
I think this is an important place, though, to mention that the exotic pet trade includes both legal and illegal or black market sales of animals. And that's what's really difficult about purchasing an exotic pet is you have to be damn sure that you know where it's coming from.
Yeah.
I mean, has anyone ever actually seen a white tiger before? I haven't.
Yeah, actually, I have. I had this amazing experience where I was touring a zoo and I was back in the surgery and I got to see a white tiger coming out of anesthetic post-op. And I had my six-year-old son with me, and we were, of course, behind the cage. But the thing you have to remember about cats when they're coming out of anesthetic is they can actually be quite mobile before they will give you any sign that they are moving. And so what I remember is walking around that cage and its eyes just tracking my son, you know, the smallest animal in the room, as we went. But it is a massive animal, absolutely gorgeous, and it just made such a huge impact on me. There is nothing like seeing a tiger in real life, and perhaps that's part of the problem.
Well, it is part of the problem. It is a little bit of anthropomania, right? They're gorgeous animals. We would all agree with that. And so therefore, you're attracted to them.
I definitely want to hug a tiger. I still feel it, even though I know it's wrong.
Yeah, you're fighting it, but it's in there.
So you guys, you did notice that all the characters that Suzanne McDonald mentioned were guys.
Yeah, I mean, there are some pretty killer female examples as well, like Queen Hatshepsut. She lived around 1500 BC and was an Egyptian pharaoh. And she had a royal zoo that included rhinos, giraffes, leopards, and monkeys.
Hey, you know, I'm really glad you mentioned that, Erica, because we've been talking largely about collections of animals that are, you know, recent, very recent, or going back maybe a few decades. But ancient zoos like Hatshepsut's were pretty common. And there's one fantastic one created by King Ashurbanipal in what is now Iraq. That was ancient Assyria then, rich beyond belief. Every time he conquered a new territory, he'd claim the exotic beasts of the area and haul them home as symbols of his conquest. And I want to bring in Lisa Cooper to the conversation right now. She's a professor of Near Eastern Archaeology at the University of British Columbia. Lisa, do we have any idea why they did this?
We think the motivation was probably related to demonstrating the power and the control that the king had over a vast empire. So a lot of the inscriptions that we have from the Assyrian kings mentioned the various types of animals that they captured in the context of their military campaigns. So the captured animals may be symbolic, just like all the exotic plants that were also brought back from these places as well. And it was also a symbol of all the abundance and prosperity that the king could bring to the Empire of Assyria. So, for example, red deer would come from the forested areas of the Zagros Mountains of what is today Iraqi Kurdistan or Western Iran. Fallow deer, another type of deer that is mentioned, would have come from the northern part of Syria. Gazelle would have probably come from the ancient kingdom of Elam, which is in southwestern Iran. And they would have been a really nice visual testament to the king's power, his conquests, his dominion, or his control over these distant regions from all these different terrains, these mountains, deserts, and forests.
According to Lisa, not only did these kings like Ashurbanipal take home the spoils of war in the form of exotic animals and plants, he'd then hunt them.
Yeah, so one more thing that we know certainly Ashurbanipal did, another previous king by the name of Ashurnasirpal also did this, was that they hunted these animals. And we know about this from the depictions of hunting scenes that are found, again, on these carved stone reliefs that adorn the Assyrian palaces. We think that the hunting would have taken place in a space in the game park at Nineveh. And in this example, a lion or a group of lions would be released within a bounded space. Perhaps the space was fenced in or perhaps bounded by armed soldiers. And then the king, either on foot or horseback or in a chariot, would go around trying to shoot down these lions with arrows, along with other weapons like spears and daggers. By showing these scenes of hunting, this was a demonstration of the king's power, his military prowess. So the killing of a lion, which is a particularly fierce animal, for example, would have attested to the king's bravery and his strength. Deer, wild donkeys, gazelle, these are all swift animals that would highlight the king's skill and his cunning. So often he had to hide behind bushes or something, and then he would jump out and he would shoot down these animals.
Yeah, because really what the hunting says is that, yes, it was dominance to bring them back and show them off, but it's an extra dose of dominance to actually hunt them in a setting, because she points out that he's just using a bow and arrow. Right? So, I mean, he is protected. She says that space was fenced in, maybe around armed soldiers, but it's a super dramatic kind of hunting. Like, you can imagine, well, it would be inevitable, I think, that there would be an audience for this. So it really amps up the dominance thing.
Well, and now we have a whole new way that you can get attention for having those animals. We have phones with Instagram and TikTok where exotic pets can give you the adulation of millions. Take Julius the Burmese Python, who on TikTok has a video of him trying to open a door that garnered over 3 million views. Or how about Tiptoe the Tortoise, who has 5.6 million followers on TikTok, has merchandise and a fan account. I mean, the hashtag exotic pets has over 319 million views. Some of these people are licensed pen owners, but some of the backstories around these animals is super shady.
A lot of people who have that need to have likes and views and whatever, they realize that having an exotic animal is one way to do that. These people need to have them. They need to possess them and own them. And that's a pretty weird thing. But that's why the pet trade exists. Anything cute that's going to get likes and views, people are wanting to collect those and have them and use them for their own personal needs. That's exactly the same motivation that these kings had. They want to show that they have a thing. Isn't that cool? It's pretty much always the same. People never change.
That's Suzanne McDonald. And you know, Erica, Nikki, I've actually changed my mind on this whole issue a little bit because I love archaeology. I had been somewhat aware of the fact that there were these, I'll use the word fabulous, although, you know, as the animals continued to die, it wasn't that fabulous for them. But these gargantuan zoos with gardens, and it was all so exotic and somehow compelling. And I found it very difficult, even in this podcast, to lump Tiger King in with that. But I've really become persuaded that there is a thread all the way from ancient Egypt and Assyria down to the present in terms of these people, mostly men, but maybe not always, who own exotic pets.
To me, it's dominance from beginning to end. But I also think that attention aspect is creeping up, especially with social media.
There's a real attraction to breaking the laws of nature, to showing some kind of mastery over these wild things that other mere mortals do not have.
And in fact, that's why you don't have Hamster King, because hamsters aren't exotic enough. And you'll notice that in every case we've talked about, all the way from Ashurbanipal, who's bringing animals to his capital that his subjects have never seen before, that you have Tiger King owning white tigers, which very few people have seen before. It's always got to be exotic. So, you know, if I want to be Hamster King, no one is going to pay attention to me.
And the fact of the matter is, we're closer to these exotic animals than we've ever been before and way more exposed to them. I think it's much easier for someone like myself to see a white tiger than any Tom, Dick, or Harry in ancient Rome. But that can be spun into a positive. Maybe we can use this exposure to not just be entertained, but to also be educated on these animals.
You're right, although I do have a nightmare vision. We've already mentioned the fact that these, you know, they want exotic, right? Well, once you've seen white tigers 5 or 10 times, they're not exotic to you anymore. However, if this animal is a crossbreed between a white tiger and a lion, hey, well, that's something I haven't seen. Well, what's going to happen in 50 years? Are they going to be creating the weirdest crossbreeds of animals, things we've never even imagined? That would take this way beyond where I'd like to see it go.
Well, and especially as more and more animals are taken from the wild into the illegal trade to be captively bred to make more money to sell. And I think it's worth mentioning here that the more contact we have with those animals as they become increasingly available to us, we're seeing increased links with zoonotic diseases. And those diseases are the ones that jump from animals to humans. And I think we all saw in the past year what a big problem that can be when it goes completely awry and viral.
Quite literally viral.
She's like, I'm not quiet. Yeah. Yeah, we know her better.
Okay, I'm leaving.
Yeah. So that's our take on rich, interesting people owning exotic animals. Hope you enjoyed it. Goodbye, Erica. Goodbye, Nikki.
Good talking to you guys.
Bye-bye.
And thanks to all of you for listening to Anthropomania. You can find out more about this episode, including links to Ashurbanipal's zoo and Pablo Escobar's hippos. Although I've got to say, those hippos are probably going to make another appearance on Anthropomania. And on our next episode, we're going to get into the weeds on plant intelligence. It's a fascinating show. It features some amazing guests. You won't want to miss it. So subscribe to Anthropomania so you don't miss out on anything. And if you're enjoying it, leave us a rating and a review, please. It also helps other people find us. Bye for now. I'm Jay Ingram.